Toby Froese, very successful production of Taming of the Shrew, is on at the Globe at the moment. He's going to talk for a few minutes about the importance of what happens in Act One. This is, of course, an unusual play in that there's an induction scene as well as before the first act. So let's start with the induction first, just for a minute. What's the point of the induction?
Well, the induction works rather than the common perception that it's the sort of the first half of a non-existent framing device. In my head, the induction to this works like a sort of a short film before a feature, or you know, a sort of warm-up act before the main event, and it introduces and establishes a world, a set of themes, a sense of humour. And also just serves to put the whole play that you're about to see on a platform, on a pedestal that says, not this isn't real or this doesn't happen, but be on your guard. It's part of a transformation itself. And the whole play is about transformations and about reality and about shifts in perception. And the first thing that Shakespeare does structurally is shift it. And I think it's interesting, myself, I think it's interesting that he doesn't choose to conclude it at the end of the play, because I don't think he's interested in it, you know, in any way being too easily dismissed as all a dream, you know.
Mm.
And I know some productions choose very much to emphasise the bit of it that maybe Christopher's life falls asleep, but I think Shakespeare deliberately leaves that pretty vague. It's available to you if you want it. But I think it removes the sense of what you might achieve from the play in real terms if it's too easily dismissed as dream, fantasy, whatever.
Right. And then we have Lucentio and Tranio coming on, and they talk for quite a long time about study. And of course, Padua had then, as it still has, a famous university. And Lucentio is coming as a student. But that goes on for quite a long time, actually, doesn't it?
It's what you'll find about the first moments of this play are a continuation of what I just said. There is an incredible, overly laborious, over self-conscious theatricality about the start to it. It's very plotty. It's very exposition-heavy. Almost as if Shakespeare's saying, don't forget, this is a play, these are actors. And I think that is part of what's going on. The other thing that happens, of course, is that he immediately sets out two ways of thinking. He sets out one way of thinking, which is to do with, if you want a very straight academic approach to learning, to life. And he then not dismisses it, but he subverts it through Tranio. He says, it's great to live your life according to beautiful principles as long as those principles are driven by your appetites and your desire to gain. And Lucentio, being the wide-eyed naif that he is, goes, what a great idea, I can have my cake and eat it. And off they go, and they never look back. And if only he hadn't made that speech, maybe the play wouldn't have happened. You know, maybe he'd have hooked up at university and learned a thing or two, and his father would have been delighted. But of course, Tranio is a sort of mini Iago, so
yes.
It's never going to happen.
Yeah, but in any case, at this point, Lucentio sees Bianca.
Yeah.
He sees Caterina and Bianca together.
Yeah.
So we've immediately got his feelings about Bianca and the Caterina problem introduced.
That's right.
Very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And so we're watching Christopher Sly watching Lucentio and Tranio watching Caterina and Bianca fighting, and so everyone's observing everybody else, and then love happens straight away. So you've got,
yes, although it's given equal time, once Caterina and Bianca have left the stage and Hortensio and Gremio have done their little bit of plotting, and we come back to Lucentio and Tranio, Shakespeare is at great pains to point out all the things that Lucentio missed when he was watching the scene. You know, okay, fine, so he saw her coral lips to move. But he missed the main event, which was Katharina kicking a door down, you know, in my production, which is the sort of the crux of that scene, is what cannot happen. Bianca can't get married. That's what any sort of rational, sane person would have taken from that. Of course, he doesn't. And that's terribly important, again, in this play, that love is never as simple as seeing what you want to see, seeing what's on the surface. And of course, for me, that sets up hugely a sense of how you judge Bianca. You know, she's very good at letting you see what she wants you to see. And that's something that crops up in most of the scenes that she's in. There is a profound sense of her manipulating her audience, I think. So he's at pains to sort of spell that out very early on. And Tranio is also sort of given the opportunity not just to point that out to him, but to actually show a loyalty. I mean, it's, while I call him a mini Iago, he's not there yet, because he's not doing this through anything like malice. In fact, he does talk about his love for Lucentia, and it seems to be borne out. There's not much gain for Tranio as Tranio, other than the fun of dressing up as a lord, essentially.
No, and it gets quite dangerous for him later on in the play.
It gets dangerous for him, and really, he can't expect much other than kudos, a few, you know, sort of first-class meals, and maybe the odd tip or two at the end of it, if it all goes well. And the risks are huge, but then he's someone who gets off on risk. So,
yeah, and then also the disguising starts, doesn't it? We start getting people behaving as pretending to be somebody
else. Yes, exactly. We see a sort of very simple problem, and we have a completely outlandish solution, which is to swap clothes and change identities, you know, so completely that even when your servant comes in, he can't tell the difference between the two of you. And of course, on one level, you sort of go, well, why on earth do we need to do this? But on another level, again, that's the nature of this world, is that people... people are not just operating rationally, they're not just operating for gain, but they're operating for the enjoyment of that process. They're operating because life is better when you enjoy the process of gaining, of conning, of seducing, or whatever it might be. They all have a whale of a time on the ride, you know, and that's important. And come unstuck as well. And part of what, you know, Katharina later discovers is about allowing herself to enjoy it. You know, there's a real sense as she goes along about, you know, denying herself the possibility of entering into the sense of playfulness, you know, the sense of fun. It's 4 o'clock now. She cannot help herself from saying, no, it's 7 o'clock. You go, do you have to be so unerringly literal in life, you know? And clearly she is capable of doing the other. When she first meets Petruchio, she's all over him in terms of her wit, but yes, only when it's to attack.
Yes, although that's another thing which comes in immediately, because her first lines are full of puns and cleverness. So what she...
To Hortensia.
When she's talking to her father, I think it's her first line, isn't it, when she... she says, I pray you, sir, is it your will to make a stale of me among these mates?
Yeah.
So you've got the mates. Idea of playing chess with stalemate, and
absolutely.
And stale can mean a prostitute, and these people want to be Bianca's mates. And
absolutely, yeah. Mm. And again, it's derogatory, you know, it's derogatory and it's defensive, and it's not designed to make anyone laugh.
Mm.
It's designed to push away. And over the course of the play, she evolves, she changes. She sort of learns, if you want to apply that, that facility that she has with language in a way that is generous and warm. And that's the point of the Sun and the Moon scene with Vincentia.
Yes. It sets her apart as it well, does. Though, as yeah. As an intelligent... She's obviously quicker brained than everybody else on stage at that point.
She is, yes. I mean, she's... You know, other people are capable of humour, and Bianca is certainly capable of humour, but she is... She has a facility with words that's really only shared with Petruchio in the play.
Mm. Yeah.
So it does mark her. It marks her card in a way that you also immediately see when he's... especially when he's doing his sort of rhetorical flourishes in Act 1, Scene 2.
Yeah. So by the end of Act 1, the plot is wound up and we've got everything which is going to happen already beginning.
It's remarkable. I mean, he really does establish everything you need to know. He sets in motion all of the main plot, the subplot, and the tone, more importantly, of a lot of what's to come. And that all before, and you've also set up the fact that the main event, the meeting between Petruchio and Kate, while it hasn't come, is something that you are itching to happen. So he sort of got you at a beautiful cliffhanger moment, while also not just having set everything up, but some elements of the plot that are too important to miss have been suggested, repeated, and rephrased at least four times. You know, the whole process of Katerina has to marry first and Bianca has to wait until she has before she can get married is repeated at least four times in different ways. In rehearsal room, it's a nightmare. You keep on thinking, why do we have to keep on saying this? But once you get in there with airplanes going over, you get it, you know. The audience need that help. And if they miss it once, they have a chance to get it again. And in some ways, he is sort of writing for an audience which are less focused on every word than someone who sits in a black box in total silence.
Well, and it goes on very well from there. Thank you very much, Toby.
No worries.